This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Seems I've yet to find my place. I'm guarding 2814.
And with that, we are back to our wonderful podcast, The Hard Traveling Fanboys, talking about one of the subjects near and dear to our hearts, Green Lantern. We have just gotten to Green Lantern Rebirth by Geoff Johns and Ethan Van Sciver, one of the more influential books on the mythos that there is. It basically completely redefined the concept for a new generation, brought back so much of what made the core magical, and also added a lot of elements to it. Todd Weber, who's with us, has been reading Green Lantern for many, many years, read the Kyle Rayner run as well, leading up to it. Talk about Rebirth and your thoughts on it, and there have been many attempts at doing retcons on characters over the years. Some of those, and a lot of those, come off as annoying to longtime fans. A lot of them don't work and don't stick. What was it about Rebirth and these specific retcons that worked for you, and why do you think Rebirth was such a successful story?
You knew exactly what was going to happen when Rebirth number one dropped. You knew that Hal Jordan was going to become the Green Lantern. You knew that DC editorial was pushing for, okay, we're going to redefine everything. Hal is the guy. He was always a hero. Evil Hal, who killed all the Green Lantern Corps in Emerald Twilight, was just this aberration. And so, you know, when this dropped with the unbelievably great Ethan Van Sciver art and Geoff Johns script, you know, there was this bigger thing at work. You could tell that they were reimagining. Oh, I went Disney. They were reimagining Hal as you know, the one true fearless Green Lantern. You know, they retold his origin just a little bit. They were leaning into that because Secret Origin was coming, but you know, they took Hal and said that, you know, the Hal Jordan that killed all the Guardians, core member, and the Guardians, and basically just kind of did the Uber Hulk Hogan New World Organization of Wrestling heel turn.
Whoa.
You say that in a mocking tone?
You know,
I have major issues.
I am sincere, brah.
Okay.
No, I think that's a really good analogy, actually.
It is. He was being Parallax, the evil Green Lantern character, it had always been there. It was always the impurity. It was the yellow aspect of the battery. It was
fear
that it was the impurity that, you know, it possessed Hal Jordan. It sensed this sadness about the destruction of Coast City, and it took root in Hal.
And one of the things I think they retconned was that the gray hairs on the side of Hal's head were caused by the self-doubt that Parallax caused him to feel.
Just stupid. Right? I mean, you could have kept
him older. No. I actually think it was stupid.
That was just like saying,
I kind of like that. Personally.
How dare there be an older guy?
This gets into some of the problems that I had, but go ahead.
No, I agree. It could have gone either way. I would have been fine with it either way. What they did was they were able to dissociate the events of Emerald Twilight with the awesome character that Hal had been for 280 issues leading up to that. Not to mention, you know, all the crossover events, everything that Hal Jordan had been since 1959. He was this awesome character, and then all of a sudden he was sad about Coast City being destroyed during the aftermath of the death of Superman. And so, you know, he became this jealous, vengeful, fearful person who eliminated the entire GLC.
The was core. The antithesis of everything that he stood for before. Like,
right.
That's the word that either Justin Rosero or Scott Criscolo can't say, right? Antithesis, well, right?
Having heard that, I would say it's probably Scott who can't say it right. So
probably because he's old, right?
No, he's just so.
No, I was so rewards. We never said anything of the kind. Please don't pull us off the site. Thanks.
No, no.
I love you guys both. I love you guys. And Scott Criscolo, your Triple H love is like onto my Cyclops love. So I feel you, bro.
Or my Hulk Hogan love, for that matter.
Oh, okay, very good. So it, yeah,
it came out of nowhere. They were able. Jeff Johns geniusly fixed it. He created the Parallax entity, which led to the Yellow Lantern Corps, which led to all of the different colors of the spectrum being represented in the different.
All the colors the of the rainbow. Corps. Yeah.
Everything. We don't have a. I guess we don't have an Aqua Corps. But
not yet.
I don't think we have an. We do will. We have an indigo?
Yes.
We do. Oh yeah. They don't speak English. They go.
Knock.
Knock.
Okay.
Knock. Knock. Walk.
All right. Very good. So, well.
Anywho.
I guess all I can say about Rebirth is it's a great story. Really enjoyed it. Jeff Johns did a masterful job of pulling all of these disparate parts of the mythos together. And the only thing that kind of sticks in my craw, which who says that other than
1940s businessman,
other than in writing, but I'll go ahead and say, is that he, I don't know, is it goes back to what Todd said on a, big picture level of it was very telegraphed of Rebirth was reinstating Hal Jordan as the guy in much the same way that Emerald Twilight drew a line under him and said Hal Jordan is out. Rebirth said that he is in, and it took great pains to make that possible. And it's one of those things that would seem convoluted if not for the finesse that Jeff Johns was able to devote to this particular story. Like, I don't know that someone else could have been able to pull that off. Like, This is the guy that made Hawkman make sense and post-crisis.
Everything together.
Yeah, in post-crisis DC Universe, which no one had been able to do. Like, that's one of those characters that I like to say became radioactive. Like, no one wanted to touch them because no one knew where to go, what to do with this character until Jeff Johns said, yeah, Hawkman, he's great. I'll fix this. I got it.
Tim, there's a reason why I think I'm the person of the five of us who probably has, in just sheer years, the least amount of experience with comics.
Mm-hmm.
And that totally makes sense why Jeff Johns is my favorite writer in all of comics.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has an ability, unlike any other writer I've encountered, to take years of chronology and years of mythos and distill them down into the high points. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
He took years of Green Lantern chronology, and in the course of six issues of Rebirth, hit the high points and made it so that anyone who didn't know Hal Jordan before Rebirth was ready to jump into Hal Jordan with Green Lantern issue one.
And importantly, he did not throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, because in bringing
Kyle Rayner.
Not only did he keep Kyle Rayner, he brought back Guy Gardner. eliminated the Warriors,
John Stewart,
and he accentuated why they were unique. He gave Kyle Rayner – people don't remember this, but Kyle Rayner had one of the best scenes in Rebirth when he's when Green Arrow is carrying him out of after the battle with Sinestro, and Green Arrow puts on the ring and tries to use it, and he can barely muster anything out of it, and he says, "My God, is it like that? I mean, my God, is that how it feels?" And then
every single time.
Yeah, it's one of the best scenes in the whole book.
And I think that was very much by design. That was Jeff Johns saying, look, this is not me kicking Kyle to the curb. Like, he's still really, like, a valid interpretation of Green Lantern as a character. I'm not trying to, you know, step on anybody's toes here. Like, I want to keep Kyle around, but Hal needs to come back into the spotlight here. And it's like Todd said before, it's having your cake and eating it too. And not that there's anything wrong with that and the way that Jeff Johns carried this off. But the one problem that I do have in the execution of this, and admittedly it's pretty minor, was the whole Parallax deal. Okay. It was like, just as we were talking about before, as it was Hal Jordan's moral event horizon. There was no coming back from this. He was corrupted, maybe through forces beyond his own control. In fairness, we can grant you that. But what Jeff Johns did was say this was not just an abstract concept that Hal had given himself over to. This was a physical, sentient entity of fear represented and personified as Parallax, which is not only something that is a psychological phenomenon, but a literal space bug that you can punch. Like, that was kind of where I was like, okay, this is a bit
much. You know what? My understanding of it was that once it infected Hal, it was inside Hal, and there was nothing Hal could do to combat it inside his mind except, mental conflict. But once Hal had expunged it outside, then it became something they could fight. And I'm a person who, looking back on it now, loves the entire...
I love
that idea. Like, it makes so much sense. And like, even as someone who...
Comic book
I
sense,
wish
not,
they would have...
Yeah, not like sense, but comic book sense.
No, comic book sense. But even as someone who wished they would have explored gray-haired Al Jordan to a deeper degree, like, I love the whole Parallax thing. I just thought
it was a bit much, I guess. Like, it would have been okay for me to say that Hal succumbed to this thing, and maybe it even was an external force, that there was an impurity in the central power battery that was this kind of ancient, malignancy that took hold of him. And at a certain point, he was beyond his ability to control his actions. Fine, fair enough, but I didn't really need that to be so, like, spelled out and explicit, I guess. But I think
the point was, you didn't need it, but a lot of people.
Yeah.
The Heat people.
They needed it. They needed
people that
it.
Witnessed Hal they, being heroic for all these years,
right. Exactly, like I said, the Heat people who needed it. What was Heat? You guys fill in for me, Todd. What was Heat?
Hal's Emerald attack slash it.
No, but instead of attack, they changed it into
advancement.
Yes,
advocacy.
But
I don't know.
The short of it was these were people who had followed Hal Jordan for the better part of 35 years, right?
1959.
They needed to know that Hal Jordan was still the hero they believed in.
And another important aspect is Jeff Johns actually writes in the afterword of my absolute Green Lantern Rebirth, which I would highly recommend, that he had no interest.
To us, Greg.
That he had no interest in telling the story of Hal Jordan seeking redemption. So for him, he wanted a way to kind of to start from square one, but not eliminate the past, embrace all those aspects. Parallax was, yes, I will readily admit, an invention of convenience. But for me, it was an invention of convenience that worked because it also spawned, to me, the greatest addition to the mythos ever.
I get it. I totally get it. I feel like, and it went so far as to, like, the thing with the gray streaks and the hair, like, I almost feel like he could have glossed over that and just brought Hal Jordan back. He looks however the way that fucking DC Comics wants him to look in 2005. You don't need to provide an explanation as to why he had gray hair in the early 90s. I don't care, but I understand that a lot of this stuff was a concession. Was a concession to the people who, you know, had an issue with the way that this character was fucked over.
You may have had an issue with it, but a lot of people who were upset with the way Hal Jordan was handled accepted these changes.
At the end of the day, it's more important to these people than it was to me. I will readily admit that. It's a minor bone of contention for me, but if it made a whole lot of people happy who were unhappy with the depiction of Hal for the better part of, you know, over 10 years, then, you know, go for it. No problem.
And it did.
Go ahead, Todd. You've been trying to say something for like five minutes now.
It solidified what the yellow impurity was. It gave the whole Sinestro / Quardian / antimatter universe thing. It made it all at least make more sense in the context of the Green Lantern universe.
I could not agree more. Like, so, it took the yellow impurity from being a vague concept.
Yep.
That was there only to kind of limit the Green Lantern.
Yeah, have some weakness.
Into a fully developed, like, this is why this exists. This makes complete, not common sense, but comics sense. I love it. And I feel this is a great opportunity.
You know what? The part of me that says this is an editorial edict and how do we make it feel organic to the creative process, I look at that and say flawless victory, honestly, because I don't know how someone could have pulled that off better than Geoff Johns. Like, to provide a rationale behind the yellow impurity and vindicate Hal Jordan at the same time, masterstroke, honestly. I just think in the execution there are certain things that didn't work for me that could have been done differently and would have worked just as well, but I know what they were going for, and I know that they had multiple – I say they, but really Geoff Johns had multiple objectives to fulfill and to placate, you know, people that had a chip on their shoulder for a long time because of this stuff. And you know what? If they were satisfied, then good on him. You know, I was not the target audience for this whatsoever. And even having said that, I thought it was a great story, Green Lantern Rebirth. And
let's do Rebirth and let's move on. Let's do it.
And as someone who came to Green Lantern because of Rebirth, I'm kind of in the same boat with Nick. I thought that I was aware of the whole Parallax thing from Death and Return of Superman, and the like Emerald Twilight and things like that. I read all that, but I didn't, you know, really connect with Hal Jordan as a character until Rebirth and until Geoff Johns took the concept of Parallax and took it from, oh, this was just Hal Jordan's alter ego when he was a villain, to the idea of it being a living, breathing thing and turning it into its own separate character and actually exploring the idea of willpower, which was, you know, mentioned all along in Green Lantern's history, but it had never been explored as what it really was, which was an emotional response to situation. To turn that into not just an idea that they, you know, gloss over as a reasoning for a power set, but to make it a character in the book that influences the very direction of it,
yep.
You can't call that anything but genius. And the execution of it, white hair gone and everything, was fucking brilliant. And there's nothing else to say for Rebirth after that for me, is that this is the that was the defining moment of whether or not I was going to be a Geoff Johns fan. And ever since then,
and probably whether or not you would be a Green Lantern fan.
You're absolutely right. That defines my Green Lantern fandom in a single 6-issue story. And Nick touched on it perfectly, that coming into it as someone who knew very little of the history, it turned me into a Green Lantern fan. And I'll say this for people who don't like Kyle Rayner, for all those Heat people that were so anti-Kyle, I'm not going to say that Rebirth is going to turn you into a Kyle fan, but you'll damn well respect him after it.
Absolutely. I had never, when I read Rebirth, I hated Kyle. I'll be honest with you. I never liked him. I thought he was a boring character. And which is interesting because the Kyle people say the same thing about Hal. But when I read Rebirth, I came out of it loving all four of them. I always liked Guy Gardner because he was a funny kind of douche character. Yeah. But I came out of Rebirth liking all four Lanterns very, very much, and gaining new appreciation for Kyle. And the guy that doesn't get probably enough credit besides Jeff, Jeff gets plenty of credit for this, but Ethan Van Sciver – with his,
I could not agree with you more, Greg.
The way that he illustrated the different uses of the ring, that John was the architect with the military experience. Guy was more just straight ahead anger and fury. Hal was the traditional just pure concentrated willpower. And Kyle of course was using these extremely extravagant artistic creations.
Greg, you know, you and I have talked about, in the years since Blackest Night, Ivan Reis has kind of become the Green Lantern artist that people think of in the modern context. But for me,
and the DC house style, quite honestly,
but for me, it always forever will be the Green Lantern artist, the person I think of when I want to see Green Lantern in a mental image, is always going to be Ethan Van Sciver. And I feel like part of that is because, as we touched on at the beginning of part one of this podcast, my first exposure to Green Lantern was Ethan Van Sciver drawing the Sinestro Corps, which I'm sure we'll touch on in just a brief moment. One shot, like, that is, to me, even to this day, after I've read literally thousands of Green Lantern comics, that Ethan Van Sciver issue is still the one that is the most visceral in my mind, if that makes any sense. Like, that's the one that I cling to. That's the one that it will never go away for me. That Ethan Van Sciver issue.
Yeah, he really doesn't get enough credit. And I think that Russell made an excellent point in that this stuff wasn't just a means to an end. Like, as much as I might personally criticize some of the execution of what Geoff Johns did, like, that's not where it ended. Like, Parallax as the yellow impurity, the embodiment of fear, okay, that was
the part yellow of a larger story.
Yeah, it was part of a larger story. That was the yellow, you know, spectrum, and green represented will, and he would build upon that into things that, you know, never, concepts that never came into play before, but just reinforced his reimagining of this character. So it wasn't just, let's get from point A to point B. It's, you know, let's tell this story, and it's just the beginning of what's to come. So
yeah, and it was the beginning of the rewriting of Sinestro from being a one-dimensional villain into being this really complex, compelling character that in many ways is just as much the focus of Geoff Johns' 10-year run as Hal Jordan was.
If anything, Geoff Johns has even said it himself in hindsight that as much as it was about bringing Hal Jordan back, it was more about the redemption of Sinestro and
absolutely
taking him from just being, you know, the classical mustache twirling villain that he had been portrayed as before to being such a deep, complex character that you almost start to root for him in a way once you find out all of this backstory that Geoff Johns has injected into it.
I liken him to the Magneto yes, of the DC Universe.
Very much so. That is a perfect comparison.
Completely agree, Russell. And
which is insane because...
I mean, it tells something that when DC saw fit to relaunch their entire universe with the New 52... Who was on the cover of Green Lantern number one?
It was Sinestro.
It was Hal Jordan. It was Sinestro.
Yep.
And that was very telling.
But
that's crazy to me because Sinestro was, in my mind, always just a pure villain. And you don't really have too many of those in comics these days. There's always the shades of gray, or you want to be able to sympathize, if not empathize with them in some way.
Mm-hmm. From someone who read Green Lantern Rebirth issue 1, from Green Lantern Rebirth 1 on, it was made clear that Sinestro was never going to be treated in that fashion.
Yeah.
It absolutely was. It was telegraphed very early on that Sinestro was not just going to be there to be a one-off foil just to get this story started. This was a story about him, about the deeper side of his personality, the deep bond between he and Hal Jordan. And the greatest, I think the greatest quote that Sinestro ever had was in Geoff Johns' final issue of Green Lantern, when he says that the greatest tragedy of all this is that he and Hal Jordan will always be friends.
Exactly.
And that,
yeah.
That, if that doesn't just sum up the entirety of Geoff Johns' tenure on the character, nothing will.
Can we touch on that
in a bit later?
Sure.
Well, I thought that I was content with Sinestro just being a pure villain. Like, as few and far between as those types of characters are, like, I'm thinking like the Red Skull. You know, Sinestro was very much in that vein for a while, and I was content with that. I never thought that I would be able to accept and even glom on to a Sinestro that was a little bit more layered and had shades of gray and was, like you said, the Magneto of the DC Universe. Like, I never thought that could work, but it did.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show, each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials one and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcast? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans are wrestling. Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are.
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover.
Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pav, we watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling. You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vandenberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on PlaceToBeNation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the Big Four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
On Richard and the Mailman, we talk about life with great enthusiasm, which eventually leads to disillusionment and inevitably hopelessness. But don't worry, there's lots of laughs along the way. So check us out every week or month or whatever on Richer and the Mailman.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
What I want to talk about, for at least, we need to spend a little bit of this podcast on it, because without it, I don't feel we've covered Green Lantern efficiently. Geoff Johns and Pete Tomasi took character from being a one-note comedy douchebag character to being perhaps one of the most well-rounded characters in all of comics. One of my favorite characters in all of comics in the week of Green Lantern Rebirth. We got to talk some Guy Gardner on this thing, man. Let's talk some creepy Guy Gardner.
He was one of the characters that was a, you know, we talked earlier about how Rebirth was very much a recovery project in many ways for several characters. Hal Jordan, most notably, but Jon Stewart as well. But Guy Gardner was arguably just as much of a rescue project.
And if you read Rebirth, it's pretty hard to debate the most iconic moment of Rebirth not being Guy Gardner writing "Bye Bye Bats" across his ass on the window of the watchtower, like
which was actually in a Recharge.
Yeah, that was in Recharge. Yeah,
that was in Green Lantern Corps Recharge.
Not bad.
And it was I would agree. I was actually about to mention that scene, Nick, as being like the moment that I became a true Guy Gardner fan was right when I saw that.
Whoa, man. Guy Gardner. He is.
And the beauty of when what Johns did with Rebirth, and then with he and Dave Gibbons actually on Recharge.
Dave Gibbons for only 6 issues though. That's one of the things I want to touch on. Like, Dave Gibbons deserves a lot of credit for those 6 issues, but really the man who needs to be like praised above all else is Pete Tomasi. Pete Tomasi, to me, is like the Guy Gardner equivalent of. I'm trying to think of an example, and I'm really having trouble. He is the, you know how Mike Grell is to Green Arrow. To me, yep. Pete Tomasi is the Guy Gardner.
Very like, much so.
I will never be able to
associate great comparison
any other creator to Guy Gardner that well, way.
We also have Pete Tomasi to thank for Jeff Johns. Because he was Jeff Johns' really? Editor
yes.
on okay. a few books before Johns. It was Tomasi's recommendation that got Jeff Johns' pitch for Green Lantern Rebirth in front of the folks in charge.
Exactly. I don't think I ever knew that. That's a really interesting
factoid. Yeah, Johns goes into a lot of this in that the interviews in the back of Rebirth. He talks about Pete Tomasi being integral because I think Pete was his editor on – it wasn't Flash. I think it was on JSA or Teen Titans, one of the others.
It was Teen Titans.
And they grew a good rapport. And when Johns wanted to do Rebirth, Tomasi read it, loved it, went with it. And Dave Gibbons was originally going to write Core, and he did for a little while, even after Recharge, I think. And then when Gibbons decided to leave, it was Johns that convinced Tomasi to come down and write Core. And that's where we got Kyle Rayner getting redeveloped, where we got the wonderful new characters like Issamat Kol and Vath and Sora Nicknatu. Who are great, amazing characters with great stories.
And the introduction of one of your favorites, Greg, Sodom Yacht.
Sodom Yacht, yes. Absolutely. And the but through it all, Guy Gardner has always been one of Tomasi's pet projects. Tomasi considers him his favorite character.
And I feel like we're talking about Tomasi taking on Guy Gardner as Guy Gardner when he took him. But without us touching on where Guy Gardner was when Tomasi left him, I feel like the story is incomplete because I feel inadequate to really describe.
To your point, I feel like if it had not been for Pete Tomasi sort of picking up this character in Guy Gardner and seeing something in him that he very much could have fallen towards the wayside. Like,
I agree.
If any and other editor or any other writer had been involved in this, it would have been like, collateral damage. We don't really need him. And
we haven't written the thing yet, but by the time this podcast airs, Greg and I will have had a countdown of our 5 favorite Green Lantern characters. And if not number one, number two on mine is going to be Guy Gardner. And a spoiler. Large reason for that. Well, you know.
Retro spoiler.
Yeah. If it's out by then, it won't matter.
Exactly.
It's because in the early 90s and the late 80s, I mean, you guys know, Guy Gardner was treated as a one-note comedy character.
And an effective one at that.
No, I'm not saying he wasn't
a effective. A one-punch character, if you will.
A one-punch comedy character.
And yeah. I enjoyed his relationship with Ice, a.k.a.
Yes.
What was her name? Tora Olofstadter.
Yeah.
Tora Olofstadter.
But I'm saying that Pete Tomasi and Jeff Johns took this character from being a one-note, overbearing douchebag mm-hmm. into being perhaps even more relatable than Hal Jordan was. Like, when I read Green Lantern comics today, understanding it from the perspective that Pete Tomasi and Hal Jordan, you know, Pete Tomasi and Jeff Johns kind of attacked Guy Gardner from, I find Guy Gardner to be much more relatable than Hal Jordan is for me personally, because I can kind of relate to the guy who kind of has this sarcastic douchebag attitude who has trouble relating to people. I think the work they've done with Guy Gardner is, I mean, it's fascinating. Like, how they've taken a character who was viewed for the better part of 15 years as being one note and kind of rounding him out and
making him
a fully realized, you know, corner of the Green Lantern universe.
It was a little bit deceptive the way that he sort of creeps up on you, because he was championed by a particular creator. So even if you weren't, as a reader, real high on this guy before, he gets under your skin and you think, oh, he's pretty integral to this series and this concept that I love so much. And you're going to have a real problem with him being kicked to the wayside. So it was a great way to, you know, bring him back into circulation after he had been marginalized for a pretty long period of time, honestly.
And you get his, you get a great origin story for him in Green Lantern Corps Zero.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which was, Peter, that was all, that was during Peter Tomasi's run.
Is that and, New 52?
Yeah, yes. That was New 52 Green Lantern Corps Zero.
Like, that's one of the things I kind of, it's kind of weird talking about. Like, do you discuss Guy Gardner in his context, you know, pre-Flashpoint or post, you know, it's a...
I think it's the same, it's the same character, but I think what Tomasi did is went in and did what Jeff Johns did for Hal Jordan and cleaned up some of the elements of the origin.
Absolutely.
To make it, you know, where it, he wasn't hit gave, in the face with a bus, you know?
It gave Guy such... it felt like...
Thanks, Greg.
To me, it felt like it gave Guy the level of depth that he's always truly needed, but maybe Peter Tomasi had been so concentrated on moving the character forward that he hadn't looked back into his past enough in order to establish a firm foundation. But then GLC Zero comes out and does just that.
It gives him a family. It gives him a hometown. Family, it gives him a background of his own to where he's very much his own character.
Exactly. His relationship with his father, his attempts at being a police officer that were, you know, completely and utterly failed, and he's always judging himself based on that, which explains his kind of douchey nature that he's always – he's trying to stand out. He's trying to be more than the sum of his parts. His great relationship with his sister, who's always, you know, kind of his shoulder that says, you know, you aren't to be proud of who you are. And
That was
another one of those pivotal moments for me, because I've mentioned it to Greg many times that I do love Guy Gardner. I love reading, especially now with Red Lanterns. But for me, the character that I've always latched onto has been between Hal Jordan and John Stewart. But with Peter Tomasi's handling, and now with Charles Soule's handling of Guy Gardner, I can't wait to read this guy every single month, because his story, ever since Tomasi got his hands on the character and redefined him, it's just been one of those moments, and it's one of those rare moments in comics where you say you've taken a character who could have easily been just pushed off and forgotten about and turned him into must-read comics.
Yes, yes, well said.
I love the fact that me bringing up Guy Gardner was able to derail the conversation for about 25 to 30 minutes. Because that's how much I love Guy Gardner.
More spoiler people should alert, love him.
If you haven't read Greg and I's countdown of our top five Green Lantern characters, Guy Gardner's going to be at the top of mine.
And that's not just the alcohol talking.
No, that's my, like,
yeah, this thing's already written.
It's difficult to find, for me, a more relatable character in comics than Guy Gardner. Because, well, here's what Guy Gardner is to me. Guy Gardner is a lot of bravado and a lot of macho and a lot of sarcasm that is masking a whole hell of a lot of insecurity on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, like, to me, Guy Gardner and I are very similar individuals.
We're getting really philosophical and deep on this.
I agree.
But we need to move it along.
We started off with this Guy Gardner topic as an offshoot of Green Lantern Rebirth. And so, Greg, I believe what you're about to say, we need to move on from, we touched on Green Lantern Rebirth, let's move into Jeff Johns. He took over Green Lantern Rebirth. Let's move into his run as a whole in the build-up to Sinestro Corps War, correct?
Yes, well, even encompassing Sinestro Corps War, because we're desperately running out of time, folks. It's like a 1996 episode of Nitro here. We are desperately running out of time. But
well,
we are
show along, we'll just Tony.
Go into the overrun on Thunder, though.
That's right. We have Thunder every Thursday night on the Superstation. But let's talk for a little bit about the overall Jeff Johns run. We'll cut it short of Blackest Night and kind of take that through the New 52 era after that. But one of the things that I love.
So, wait a minute. Where are we stopping?
We're gonna stop after Blackest Night.
After Blackest Night, shit.
And then summarize it after. We'll summarize the whole run. But the beauty of Jeff Johns' run, or one of the things that is beautiful about his run and his work with great artists, Ethan Van Sciver, Carlos Pacheco, Ivan Rice, Doug Mankey, is throughout it all there was a clear story that he was going to tell, but he was patient with it. I think there's a tendency from some writers to rush stories because they don't know how long they're going to have with the character, and I totally get that. But much like Scott Snyder has done with Batman, I think there has been even more so to a degree, there was a level of patience that Jeff Johns had in crafting these stories where things 50 issues down the line in his run paid off that were referenced very early on either in Rebirth or in the very beginning of his run with Carlos Pacheco.
It was perfect. It's long form storytelling that you can actually follow.
Exactly.
And Greg, I don't mean to call you out, but according to my timer, we can fit in about 25 minutes of discussion here. Just let me know.
We are. Like I said, running out of time a little bit, but the beauty of the Jeff Johns run was this long form storytelling, like Russell said, long form storytelling that you could actually follow. Something that I followed, you know, each and every story religiously. I couldn't wait for it to come out, and it was always he never sacrificed the immediate story for that long form story, which is a key difference between a lot of runs and even some of Jeff's runs in the past. The intermediary issues, the individual issues themselves were fascinating, were always entertaining, were always interesting in the context of this larger story where it's building something that, you know, you don't know what it is, but holy shit, you can't wait to see it come. It was just very masterfully built especially up into the lead up of what I consider to be my favorite Green Lantern story of all time, the Sinestro Corps War. What did you guys think about the build-up, Russell? I know that you were discussing this earlier.
Oh, it's just tremendous. I mean, what was so brilliant about the lead-in to Sinestro Corps War was how much time Jeff Johns spent on just these deeper, more personal stories to Hal Jordan, developing him getting back to his life after he's been, you know, quote unquote dead for quite some time. We see him going back into actually Air Force mode. If you'll remember a few stories from by the beginning of the run, we're introduced to a new love interest who uses the call sign Cowgirl.
Yep.
She was a really good, fun character that unfortunately kind of got shoved to the wayside as the run went along. But there were a lot of really good, deeper moments there that showed Hal Jordan as the hero without his ring. Like, there were instances where he had to prove, you know, I guess it was meant to prove in the reader's mind that this guy wasn't just his powers. This guy was a hero without it.
Exactly.
And you got to see that as his story developed. And as important as it was to see him, you know, reestablishing the Green Lantern Corps, that was really kind of being handled over in the actual Green Lantern Corps book, and the main Green Lantern title was just focusing on let's rebuild Hal Jordan from the ground up, and that starts by building him without his ring and just reestablishing him in his life. But all the while, you've got all this stuff happening in the background that maybe seemed innocuous all along, but that first time you see a yellow ring shooting off into space in the short-lived Ion title that ran around the same time, you knew something big was coming, and you didn't know what exactly, but you were like, "That was a yellow ring." I was like, "What? That, you know, was the old Sinestro weapon from way back in the day. Could this be building to something that's more than just, you know, another?" Sinestro gets his ring back and comes after Hal Jordan, and boy did it. It was this gigantic, expansive, like It actually became a DC event, for lack of a better term, even though it was right around the same time as Geoff Johns' other big event, Infinite Crisis. It took place after it, actually.
Slightly after.
Yeah, very slightly after. After all that craziness that went on in Infinite Crisis, here comes the Sinestro Corps, and you start seeing just some all these amazingly crazy concepts thrown out there. Superboy Prime being a member of the Sinestro Corps, and then the freaking Anti-Monitor, showing up as
you gotta understand that, like, I read Sinestro Corps as someone who was not versed in DC continuity at all. Like, to me, as someone who had never read a DC comic in my life, even at that point, I thought Superboy/Superman Prime was the most badass, coolest fucking thing I'd ever seen in my life. You know what I mean?
He was a great villain under Johns. And that was another thing that Johns did during his run, was he established that character not just through Infinite Crisis, but then when he put him in Sinestro Corps,
absolutely,
he turned him into something even more, because it was like, all right, this villain has gone from being, you know, a potential Superman foil to being a Green Lantern villain. And what a brilliant transition that was. It was ultimately short-lived, but for that short amount of time that he was there and handled properly by Geoff Johns, that was just like masterstroke to put him in there and to establish him as a true threat, and making him a member of the Sinestro Corps made so much sense. Especially like that scene when we've been building up to Sodom Yacht making his debut, the Daxamite Green Lantern, who is essentially Kryptonian, but not weak to kryptonite, but instead weak against lead. Don't ask. It's a long, convoluted bunch of craziness. But you get into this big built-up fight. He's got all the powers of Superman and a Green Lantern all rolled together. This guy should be the most powerful thing in the whole universe, and Superboy Prime beats him down like he is a small child.
I don't feel like that should be a complaint, because I really feel like that served the overall story.
It did. It served the I was actually using it as a positive, because we've been built up to believe that Sodom Yacht's just going to come in here and save the whole day. No, Sodom Yacht's going to come in here and get beaten within an inch of his life.
And you're right.
Superboy Prime is just going to hold him and say, all right, who's next?
And it was so different from superhero comics, because you're right, the way that they had presented Sodom Yacht was not unlike the way that characters like the Sentry, for instance, were introduced, where it's the way that they're written and drawn, it makes it apparent that, okay, they're going to try to push this character down our throats as being the next big deal. Damage during Zero Hour was the same way.
Oh.
And yet what they did is they totally flipped your expectations, and they made Sodom Yacht have vulnerability and actually seem like a relatable character, and it only made it even more impossible. Or like, how in the world will the heroes win this time?
And
hey, Gorilla.
Yes.
Yes, Art.
All right. So I have acknowledged that I have yet to read Sinestro Corps War.
What the fuck, by the way?
Exactly. That's a fair assessment. I kind of look at it this way. It's a little bit like a fine wine, where I have it, it's in my wine cellar, really looking forward to busting it out, but just waiting for the right opportunity kind of thing. And it's going to be soon. Don't get me wrong. Like, I have no doubt that I will enjoy it.
This is how I would equate it. You've got it in your cellar. It's a fine wine.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a couple drinks. You're at that point where, like, you got a little buzz going, and it's a good night, but that, you know, if you have, like, one more really good drink, it goes from being a good night to being, like, one of the best nights in your life.
And I'm just going to kill the bottle.
And then you take in Sinestro Corps War, and you take in the bottle, and it's, like, the best solo drinking night you've ever had in your existence.
If Rebirth was the red wine you had with your great steak dinner, I would call Sinestro Core War the nice iced dessert wine that you're going to have with your gelato afterwards. It's just going to knock you on your ass.
This works for me. The one thing that I'm wondering in my Hey Gorilla moment, you'd mentioned the ANSI monitor, and mm-hmm. he was the central plot device driving the original.
Let's not shit ourselves. He was the biggest bad of all the big bads in the DC universe for the better part of two decades.
Yeah. And it looks like
he's about to play again.
And here's the thing that kind of blows my mind and might blow your mind. I don't know. Crisis, you know, Crisis is all centered on how are we going to beat this guy? And we do beat this guy. And what ultimately happens is the universe gets restarted. Well, the multiverse gets restarted and consolidated into one very streamlined continuity. And the fact of that was, in this new streamlined one DC universe, what the events that we saw play out and the multiverses getting destroyed and consolidated and reborn and blown up and what have you, and Crisis on Infinite Earths, and how they just, did I say Earths? But anyhow, as they defeated the Anti-Monitor in that story, the way that we saw that was not necessarily the official canon, right? As of the new post-Crisis DC universe. Like, the characters as of that point in the rebooted continuity had a recollection of there was a crisis, but multiverses were never a thing that we really had any knowledge or recollection of.
Except Harbinger, right?
Except Harbinger, well, and the Psycho Pirate.
Right.
And
for a brief time, Wally West.
Yep.
Okay, yeah. And so the Anti-Monitor was a character and a villain that they fought, but the way that they defeated them to their recollection as of this new continuity was not necessarily what we saw as it played out in Crisis on Infinite Earths. Does that make any sort of sense whatsoever?
Like, yeah, I follow it. I don't know if anybody else in the world can, but I
know that's the thing. This is what happened, but because it was rewriting history at the same time as it happened, it maybe ultimately happened differently. You know, it's very convoluted and very hard to explain these things that are happening. You know, it's kind of like tripping over your own shoes sort of thing.
And this brief segue into All Things Confusing brought to you by our next little get-together, Crisis on Infinite Podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm wondering, what I'm ultimately getting to is the Anti-Monitor's involvement in Sinestro Corps War, was that built on like the fact that what we thought happened in Infinite Crisis was not really what happened as the characters?
It was tied to the Antimatter universe and Cord and its place in the new post-Crisis DCU. Basically, they tied the Anti-Monitor into... They basically revealed that he was from the Antimatter universe, and it's kind of left vague as to what actually happened in Crisis.
But not just what Greg... In addition to what Greg just said, which is completely on point, but the fact that the Anti-Monitor had been defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And so the entire point was to instill fear in the greater DC universe. Well, if the Anti-Monitor has been defeated, how can he instill fear? So he teams himself up with this larger threat in an effort to make himself more terrifying, if that makes sense to the larger...
Well, it instills fear in me as a reader. I can tell you that much, because I think I know one thing, and then they say, we can play a little bit fast and loose with this since
I think that... The way that they went about it with Anti-Monitor was basically saying that the crisis happened, he was defeated, he went back to the, they thought they had vanquished him, but he really just went back to the antimatter universe.
Yeah.
What happened leading
and
into
the multiverse stuff didn't really happen because they didn't, you know,
except
Superman didn't know shit about multiverses and
right. But
Earth
see, Infinite
1
Crisis,
versus Earth 2. And
yeah, and I think Infinite Crisis actually put that back into canon, if memory
it did. Memory Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The entire multiverse.
Yeah.
That's a good point. This was right following was. On the heels of that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because the big reveal of 52 was 52 worlds. But anyway, we've gotten to the side. We have to wrap things up. We're getting to the end. We got so much we haven't talked about.
Right. We have about 15 minutes for my time.
But are you certain? Yeah.
I'm sure. Yes.
It actually gives us a good segue with the anti-monitor because honestly, he was a means to an end. Because if you when you get to the end of Sinestro Corps War, and the anti-monitor seems to be dying, a voice calls out in the darkness and consumes him, turning him into a Black Lantern power battery, which is the big segue into the biggest event that Geoff Johns had done up to that point, which was Blackest Night.
Yep. Oh, shit.
And so, which was built to over the course of the next year through events like Rage of the Red Lanterns.
About, you know, Sinestro Corps.
So. Yeah, and through Rage of the Red Lanterns, one of my personal favorite stories, Agent Orange, which introduced my all-time favorite Geoff Johns creation, Larfleeze, the Great and Powerful. Or, I'm sorry, the Great and Terrible.
May I, Greg?
May mine.
Yes, mine.
May I read the Orange Lantern Corps Earth?
Oath, you mean?
Yes.
Earth.
What's mine, it's mine, and mine, and mine, and mine, and mine, and mine, not yours.
And there it is.
I love that there's just an aspect of the, you know, the core or the, you know, emotional spectrum that is centered on not something that is especially virtuous, but is kind of shitty, but very like true to life, you know, like it can't all be, you know, wine and roses all the time.
Well, by that same token, look at the Red Lantern Corps.
Oh yeah.
With blood and rage of crimson red. Ripped from a course so freshly dead, together with our hellish hate will burn you all, that is our fate. Like,
yeah. It's like we are the poster children of having a chip on our shoulder kind of thing.
Go ahead, Russell.
The entire emotional spectrum is really built around a central idea that the other six cores represent emotions that are sitting on a balanced scale, and the green power of will is the scale. So you take any one of these emotions by themselves and they aren't necessarily useful. You temper any one of them with will, they become nearly unstoppable.
One of Geoff Johns' greatest creations, probably the greatest creation to the Green Lantern, or addition to the Green Lantern mythos, was the emotional spectrum that opened the door to all these different cores, the Red Lanterns, the Blue Lanterns, the Indigo Tribe, Larfleeze, the Great and Terrible.
And the entire thing is built on the idea of rings, including the emotional spectrum itself. A lot of people think of it as the balance, and you have ones that go to the extreme of one side and the extreme of the other. But it's true what they say when they say there is a thin line between love and hate. So it's essentially theoretically possible that it wouldn't take much for a Star Sapphire to suddenly go off the deep end and suddenly be taken over by a red ring.
Exactly.
Because they are so close together because those two ends of that spectrum are linked, and then you just follow the rest all the way around with green in the middle.
And the one of the many wonderful aspects of this emotional spectrum, they kind of stopped playing with this after a while, it felt like. But one of the things I loved in those, especially through Blackest Night, was the effect. It was basically, for a fan, it was really fun. It was like being a kid again because each ring had different effects on the others. Some rings were effective against others. Some were completely ineffective against others. So it was actually really, like, for me, it was like being a kid again whenever they'd have these massive battles because you had the blue rings could make the green rings stronger.
It's really like, Greg.
But yeah, go ahead.
If you wanted to help a child understand the American system of checks and balances, like, in a perfect world, that's what the emotional spectrum would be like, right?
Yeah,
like,
very much so.
You're gonna help each child understand that like certain rings are ineffective against certain rings, whereas you know other rings.
Hope on its own is not enough, but yeah. Hope coupled with will is unstoppable.
Exactly, like checks and balances against checks and balances.
Well, but, it reminds me a lot of you know me coming at this as a Marvel guy, right? Like. Before any of this stuff, and I'm not saying that Geoff Johns drew on any of this. He probably didn't because they aren't really that interconnected or you know organically related until you start looking at it as hey, there's this and then there's that. Like in the Marvel Universe, you had the Infinity Gems and. There were six gems that were different abstract concepts, basically. And each of them alone was capable of great power and great feats, but combined, they could do extraordinary things. Like, the power gem combined with the mind gem would give you omnipotence, essentially. And... Or the power gem with the time gem could give you total control over the chronology of the universe type of stuff. And then you had the Infinity Gauntlet as wielded by Thanos, which was all six gems in conjunction, which gave him absolute power over reality, and he could do anything, was like onto a god type of thing. So... I kind of see how it works. Like in my mind, I can, you know, parse these out coming at it as, you know, the Marvel guy and trying to see how these things are sorted out and interact with one another. It's a neat mapping that you can do, and they're not all that dissimilar.
Definitely. You know, I definitely can see the parallels and the emotional spectrum being a little bit, you know, a little bit different in that they're, you know, they're more based upon a certain edict or whatever behavior yes. pattern that you had to have.
But it's like they're all abstract concepts. And what do you do with that? Like, how do you mm-hmm. personify that?
Exactly. So. And each one and especially as the stories progress and you saw how other than the orange rings, everybody that wields these rings wields them in different ways. Mm-hmm. So it's just a great concept. And I'm going to go ahead and we're going to try to wrap up the look back on John's run.
May I very quickly read the Orange Lantern 4-0?
You already have, Nick.
Did I really?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you did that already.
Just a few minutes ago. Folks, you can't write this stuff. We the Geoff Johns run to me is everything I love about Green Lantern. But Russell, what does it mean to you?
Pretty much my comic fandom, actually. It was, you know, around the time in 2004, whenever I was just really starting to get back into comics, and I had been reading the J. Michael Straczynski Amazing Spider-Man run collected in trade format. And that was pretty good, but as it was going along, I was starting to say, all right, well, I don't know if I'm going to wind up sticking with this, and I kind of want to try out some new things. You handed me Rebirth, and it's been a constant Geoff Johns love fest for me ever since. I've gone back to read just about everything the guy's ever written, and from there, it kind of segued out into, okay, well, what else is going on at DC that I might have been missing out on all these years? And it's turned into this, you know, absolute love of everything I can get, just about everything I can get my hands on, not just from Geoff Johns, but from other writers. Like, of course, Peter Tomasi was, you know, the next go-to. Mm-hmm. And it's segued into more modern writers today, like Robert Venditti.
Van Jensen,
Charles Soule, and, of course, over in the Batman family, Scott Snyder and Kyle Higgins. And, of course, I kind of rediscovered Gail Simone as a result, too, because of her and Geoff Johns' friendship. And they're like talking back and forth on panels and things like that. It's all thanks to this one run, really, that kicked off this whole thing. So, yes, my entire comic book fandom can really now be linked directly to one guy and his one run on this character, because it defined everything for me.
Very, very well said. And what I'd like to do is go around the panel and to close things out, to get everybody's favorite Green Lantern moment, or the moment that most sums up Green Lantern for you and your personal experience. Nick, I'm going to start with you. The moment, your favorite Green Lantern moment, or the moment that just screams Green Lantern the most to you?
It's completely apropos. As much as I love Green Lantern, and we've discussed throughout this two-part podcast that I've read Green Lantern in chronological order, none of that would have happened without the Geoff Johns run on Green Lantern. And so, for me, a moment that sums it all up is a moment that, to me, distills Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run down in one bit of dialogue. And it's when it says... It's when Sinestro is speaking to Hal Jordan at the end of Green Lantern 20, and he says that this is the tragedy of all of this. We'll always be friends. And it's that moment between Dahl Sinestro and Hal Jordan where you realize that, like, as much as they've been antagonists over the years, that, like, it really came from a place of deep caring, of where Sinestro wanted Hal to be the best that he could. And so if I'm picking one moment of the entire mythos, it's that moment in Green Lantern 20. And for a small, you know, like, side moment, it's the moment where we see in the epilogue in Green Lantern 20, wrinkled old woman Carol Ferris holding the hand of wrinkled old man Hal Jordan, and we get to know that, like, ultimately, they found their happy ever after together. So those two moments, that's what I'm doing at you.
Excellent picks. Tim, your favorite Green Lantern moment, or the most Green Lantern moment to you?
You know, it goes back to what is not traditionally thought of as a Green Lantern story, but takes place during the reign of the Superman.
Yes.
After Coast City has been annihilated. Just nuked by the cyborg Hank Henshaw, Superman doppelganger, and Mongol. Yep. Mongol in particular. And Hal Jordan comes upon the scene, and he's essentially a bystander to this. He's like, oh my God, this happened. Where was I? How was I unable to stop this? How did I not see this coming? How is this just news to me, basically? And he's powerless to do anything about it. And he is just driven into a rage. Like, he sees red. Like, you know, you talk about the emotional spectrum. His reaction when he comes upon this scene has very little to do with the green spectrum of willpower. Like, he is a man possessed, basically, and just runs roughshod over Coast City and Mongol and all of his goons and everything else, and comes face to face with Mongol, pretty much gets beaten down. And it was interesting in the way that this story positioned Mongol as sort of a big bad for Green Lantern, which he had never been before and had no reason to be until this particular sequence of events. And, you know, it comes down to Hal is ultimately powerless to, for all of his ability and for what he can accomplish with his vast powers, he can't reverse what happened. He can't turn back time, but he can sure as shit take out his rage and his frustration and his anger on Mongol. And by God, does he do that. And he does it pretty much as a man, as Hal Jordan, not as, you know, this avatar of willpower, but you know, just to say, you are not going to beat me. Like, you can conquer my city, you can kill my friends and family, but at the end of the day, you will not win. Like, as battered and broken, as beaten as I am, like, I will find a way. That's the power of will. And I think that really speaks to the heart of the Green Lantern concept. You know, when he picks up the, you know, the hammer and just does what he can to overcome the odds. And, you know, he can't do but so much at that point. But he grabs that hammer and he fucking bashes Mongol and takes him out. And that's pretty much the end of his contribution to that storyline. And Mongol is done. And granted, later on, he does become a recurring character and a threat for Kyle Rayner once he comes into the picture. But it was just a very triumphant moment for Hal and for what Green Lantern and the concept of willpower represented. So
absolutely. I remember that. And he had the broken arm and everything.
He had the broken arm, you know, his arm was in a sling, like his knee was totally shattered. And it didn't undo anything that Mongol had done. But it was just Hal saying, you know what, at the end of the day, I'm going to get the last laugh and fuck you.
Absolutely. Great moment, great moment. Russell, your favorite Green Lantern moment?
It actually came very early on, and it's one that always sticks in and amongst all these just incredible Green Lantern moments over the entire Geoff Johns run. But it goes back to Green Lantern Rebirth. The scene, I mean, we've been building up to this scene for, you know, like almost, I think, 4 or 5 issues worth of the story. Sinestro is going after Hal's ring, and that's still on his, like, on our, not his ring, but there's, he wants Hal's body for reasons that I can't exactly remember. And he's been battling Green Arrow and Kyle Rayner through this whole thing, and essentially winning the battle. But there's a moment when Hal's body is reanimating. It's coming back to life. The little hairs, the white hairs on the side of his head turn back to brown. His ring shoots into the room and attaches to his hand. And he stands up in full Green Lantern uniform, looks right at Sinestro, and tells them to get the hell away from them. As that, it's a perfect Ethan Van Sciver moment too. It's iconic, as he's, you know, standing there perched with his ring just all lit up, and it's forming a Green Lantern emblem behind him. Just that is just powerful imagery for me, and it kind of sums up what, you know, got me to keep reading this story. It was like the triumphant return of, you know, the once and future hero. And a close second is when Hal Jordan totally one punches Batman in that same story.
Oh man, great stuff. Yeah, that iconic Van Sciver image, I remember it. You know, I remember seeing it for the first time and just getting the feeling, the same feeling I got when Jim Lee drew Batman, that, you know, this is the image that I'm going to take with me as like my favorite look.
And that's why, to me, Van Sciver is always going to be the Green Lantern artist as compared to Ivan Reis or Doug Monke or whoever you will. To me, it's always going to be Van Sciver.
Well, I will finish off with my favorite Green Lantern moment. There are so many great ones. I'm tempted to go with what Nick said earlier, the scene between Hal, and Russell mentioned as well, the scene between Hal and Sinestro and Green Lantern 20 in the New 52, the end of Geoff Johns run. However, the scene that I'm going to go with is actually from the Sinestro Corps War, and it is over the course of Hal Jordan's comeback, he had to earn people's trust back. Coast City was just being reborn, basically, and people were afraid to move there. It used to be the city without fear, and now it was the city everyone was afraid of. They didn't want to go there. Nobody trusted Hal, really. Nobody wanted to live there. And Hal was still dealing with his own guilt and remorse of everything that had happened. And there's a moment in, I think it's number 25, Green Lantern number 25, the last issue of the Sinestro Corps War. If not, it was in 24. And Hal is talking to his family, and he's telling his family to leave town because the Sinestro Corps has hit Earth, and they're destroying. They're tearing everything apart. The heroes are losing the battle. And Hal says, you need to get out of Coast City, get as far away from here as you can. And instead, his family says, no, we're staying. And everybody else is staying too. And all of a sudden, like, all of Coast City pretty much lights up in support of the Green Lantern Corps, and his brother actually tells him, go light him up, Hal. And it was this incredible moment that just summed up that Hal Jordan was back, that the Green Lantern Corps was back, and it was this moment of inspiration that kind of – it was almost like a moment – I know that Jeff didn't want to tell the story of redemption, but that felt like the story of redemption for Hal Jordan, the story of redemption for longtime fans. And for me, it's the moment that I think of when I think of what is Green Lantern. It's that willpower – even in the face of incredible adversity, knowing that you're probably going to lose and still staying there and fighting. And
it's that great feel-good moment. Yeah.
Yes, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And with that, we've come to an end of our incredibly long podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. All you Green Lantern fans, tweet us, Facebook us, email us, whatever, to give us your favorite memories of the character. A lot of fun. Nick Duke, my fellow hard traveling fanboy. Russell Sellers, you can catch him every week on Place to Be. Tim Capel, numerous columns. Todd Weber had to drop out earlier, but we thank him. He's awesome. And we hope to be back around the bend with some more podcasts eventually down your way, hopefully next month. All right, thanks a lot, guys. From the corner of my eye, I catch a glimpse of evil light. The fear tries to swallow me like I'm just some guy with an emerald. Everything. A purple man obsessed with me, so lost to the dark, and it's now extinct. From any good it once possessed, pledged to the oath, now laid to rest. No time for doubt, no quick eject. Don't give in to fear like my father.